Just keep the thing under control, okay, Sean? Kate asked. Sean glanced between her and the monster. We're running out of time, Carr reminded everyone. Kate checked the attachments on the microelectronic array attached to the bioreactor. Recheck everything. Make sure nothing is interfering with Sammy's work. And the sedatives? Sean asked. Do you think they're holding things back? Sammy looked up at him from her computer. Honestly? Maybe. If the thing's brain isn't functioning at full capacity, that might be an issue. Kate didn't like the idea of pulling back on the sedatives and was surprised Sean suggested it. But they all wanted to finish. Anything to expedite their research now might be worth the risk. If you think it could help, then do it, Kate said. Sean nodded, adjusting the dials on the IV drip. What are you doing? Asked a guard. Kate explained, and the men moved closer, their weapons cradled. Please back up, Sean said as they circled around. I need some room. Kate turned her attention back to Sammy's monitor as the computer engineer typed out a few more queries to the mastermind. It took several minutes, but sure enough, the responses started to come back slightly faster and clearer. Ask if it has identified any enemy contacts in its location, Kate said. Sammy typed in the request. I am uncertain of my current whereabouts, said the mastermind's computerized reply that came over speakers. The monster's eyelids suddenly flipped open and swept the room. But I have spotted contacts all around me. Unfamiliar. They are holding me prisoner. Sammy looked up at Kate with a proud grin. Now let's see if this thing really believes we're its master or not, Kate said. Those contacts you see are your allies, Sammy typed. The chains holding the mastermind rustled as it rotated slightly. Some are allies, true, came the reply over the computer screen. See, Sammy said, her grin widening. Kate was too nervous to smile. Her family was out there in the middle of an attack, and she had no idea what was happening behind the lab walls. The sound of distant gunfire reverberated. But how was that possible? The lab was basically soundproof. It had to be her ears playing tricks on her. They would know if there were hostiles in the building. Kate returned her attention to Sammy. The young technician stared at the computer screen, her smile gone. Something isn't right. She tapped at the keyboard. It just said the connection has been terminated. The chains rattled again, the clank echoing. The soldiers closed in. Sean walked over to the sealed door and used his keycard to open it. Before Kate could ask him what he was doing, the door opened and another soldier walked in. He handed Sean a rifle. Both men aimed their weapons at the other guards. None of the four soldiers even had a chance to raise their rifles before they crumpled under a spray of automatic bullets. The gunfire echoed in the space, nearly deafening to Kate. Sammy screamed, and the other techs darted for cover. Carr was the only one that remained standing by Kate. What are you doing? He yelled at Sean. Sean swung the rifle at Carr. Shut the fuck up and don't move. The soldier that Sean had let in hurried toward the shackles holding the mastermind in place. No, Kate said. You can't do this. Sean laughed. You're more naive than I thought, Kate Lovato. Sean, please, Sammy begged. It's not too late to stop whatever it is you're doing. Shut up, you dumb bitch, Sean said, angling the weapon at her. The soldier used a key to unlock the first of the shackles on the mastermind. None of you get it, do you? Sean said, his voice booming. You used science to try and save us, but all you did was make them stronger. He angled his weapon at Kate. You created the variants, the new gods. That's not true, said Sammy. I said shut your mouth, Sean said. Kate reached out to the technician just as Sean fired. Sammy slumped to the ground, holding her stomach. No! Kate shouted. She glared at Sean, nerves firing with anger. You monster. Call me what you want, but you created the real monsters. Sean shrugged. Then he backpedaled to the mastermind, holding a gun on them. Carr and Kate bent down next to Sammy. What do we do? He whispered.
I don't know, Kate said.
She put pressure on Sammy's wound, the only thing she could do. The other technicians and engineers hid behind their stations, trembling. They could all storm Sean and the other soldier, but she wasn't sure they could get there without all being killed. Kate knew there was no way they could talk Sean and his friend out of what they were doing. The only way to stop them was to fight or hope the rest of the guards got here in time. She thought back to the gunfire she heard earlier. It must have been real after all. The man with Sean had killed the other guards. There probably weren't any other men left out there.
We have to do something, Carr said. He stood and faced Sean again. But before he could even open his mouth, Sean shot him through his face.
He hit the ground next to Kate, his eyes still open.
Chapter 25
Beckham stopped at Outpost Manchester's civilian shelter on his way to the lab. People clustered around asking questions about what was happening outside. He waved them off and pushed through the crowd until he found Horn trying to keep the kids calm.
Dad! Javier shouted. Please don't leave again!
Sorry, buddy, Beckham said. I promise everything's going to be okay.
So you'll stay?
Beckham hesitated, but his son was tough. He would understand.
I've got to go check on your mom. Once she finishes her work, we're all going to leave this place.
Good, Tasha said. Can't wait,
Jenny said with a snort.
Once the kids returned to their cots and chairs, Beckham pulled Horn aside. He found a corner they could whisper in without the kids overhearing.
How bad is it out there? Horn asked. We got hit by a bunch of rogue juveniles. Seems like they're really pressing the defenses now, and Presley kicked me out of the command building.
That son of a bitch, Weasel. I had a bad feeling about him.
Beckham thought back to the kid collaborator in the jail. He had a feeling there were more of them out there waiting to strike.
I've got good reason to believe this is going to get a lot worse, Beckham said. We have to get out of here.
Jesus.
President Ringgold will send an evac as soon as we call for it, Beckham said. If things go south and I can't get back here, you take the kids and the dogs to the tarmac, okay? Leave without me if you have to.
Screw that, Horn said. We ain't going anywhere without you.
Horn had a look in his eye that Beckham recognized, like he wanted to roll outside with the M249 and mow everything down.
The kids, Big Horn. You've got to stay with them and stay calm.
Horn clenched his jaw, but nodded, finally relenting.
Fine. What are you gonna do?
I'm going to the lab to make sure Kate's good. She told me they were almost done.
Okay.
Horn said.
He put a hand on Beckham's shoulder.
Be careful, boss.
You too.
Beckham said goodbye to the kids and dogs before returning to the street where Fisher waited with his men. The sound of distant gunfire rattled in the night, but it was more sporadic now.
Everyone okay? Fisher asked.
For now.
Beckham jerked his chin.
Let's go.
They set off with Tran and Chase down the empty road. Even the routine patrols had been called off to other areas. When Beckham reached the lab building, it wasn't guarded by a single vehicle or soldier. He wanted to march back to the command post and knock Presley out. Chase halted on the sidewalk.
They didn't even leave a single damn guard outside? That stupid son of a gun, Fisher said. What in Sam Hill was he thinking?
He's lost control. And things are about to hit the fan, Beckham said. Come on, let's find a way in.
They tried the front entrance, but it was locked. Knocking didn't help. Beckham cupped his hands over his eyes to peer through the windows in the door. No one stood guard inside either. He circled around the building and found a side door, but it too was locked, and no one answered his knocks.
I know Presley's acting like a dumbass, but it's still strange no one is in there, right? Chase asked.
Sure as hell seems strange to me, Tran said.
Think you can pick it? Fisher asked him.
If by pick you mean shoot, sure, Beckham said.
He motioned for them to get back. Then he aimed his M4 and fired at the lock. The well-placed round did the trick, and he kicked the door open. Tran went in first, keeping his rifle angled at the ground just in case there were friendlies inside. He stopped right in the entrance.
Why are the lights off? He asked. Becca moved inside.
Something's not right.
Shouldering his rifle, he took the lead. Emergency lights glowed in the nook of the ceilings, providing just enough light to guide him down the hallway. Every step he took, his pulse raced faster.
God, even Presley wasn't actually bullheaded enough to leave this place completely unguarded. Something was definitely wrong. Very wrong. Please be okay, Kate.
He stopped at an intersection and held up his prosthetic hand. Then he checked the leftward hallway. Seeing it was clear, he looked to the right. His stomach flipped. Two bodies lay crumpled. Dark blood pooled over the tiled floor, but he didn't see any sign of gashes or torn flesh to indicate variants were inside.
Collaborators already got here, he whispered.
Fisher came up next to him to have a look.
On me, Beckham whispered. Tran, watch our six. We've got at least one hostile shooter.
Without hesitation, Beckham led the way, his rifle up and finger hovering over the trigger. The lab entrance was at the end of the passage, not far from where the soldiers had fallen. He kept low, hugging the wall, barrel aimed at the door to the lab. When he reached the bodies, he halted to examine them. The men had both been shot in the back. They probably never saw the attack coming. One of their weapons was gone, which told Beckham the shooter had probably taken it to give to someone else. Judging by the looks of things, the shooter had taken the extra weapon straight to the lab. Beckham swallowed hard and kept walking. A tremor shook the ground as he passed the dead Raven guards. He almost stopped, but pressed on to the windows. As a defense mechanism against any potential mastermind escapes, the glass to the lab had been made bulletproof. That ruined any plans of shooting the hostiles from behind. They had to get inside if they wanted to take these assholes down. He crouched under those windows as he made his way to the door. A roar from the monster confirmed Beckham was going to have more than men with guns to worry about. He held his breath and got up to scan the room. A cluster of scientists huddled behind lab benches, but he didn't see Kate. Two men stood near the mastermind, one in a white lab coverall. The man pointed a rifle at another person in the lab. The other gunman was dressed in fatigues and appeared to be unlocking the shackles on the beast.
Shit, shit, shit.
Beckham ducked down before either collaborator could spot him. The creature roared inside the lab again. Fisher crouched next to Beckham.
What do we do, Captain? He asked.
Hold here.
Beckham risked another glance to search for Kate. His heart thumped when he saw her. The floor around her was covered in blood from two fallen scientists. She was crouched beside the bodies, crimson staining her white coveralls. Beckham whispered what he saw to Fisher, Tran, and Chase. They needed to get in there, fast. He crawled back to the guards' bodies to search for a lab keycard. He found two. He handed one to Fisher.
There is another entrance on the other side of the lab, Beckham said quietly to Fisher. You go there with Chase. Tran, you're with me.
Another guttural roar sounded, followed by the clanking of chains. They were running out of time. Beckham held his position to give Fisher and Chase time to get to the other entrance. The wait was agonizing. Every passing second, the beast grew louder and more enraged.
You take this, Beckham said.
He handed the keycard to Tran.
Open the door on my mark. I'll go in first.
A nod from Tran.
Our targets are at the north side, near the beast. You shoot them, but don't shoot the creature unless I tell you. Understood?
You got it, Captain.
Beckham waited another beat, then peeked to confirm the gunmen hadn't moved. They were still in the same spot. He glimpsed a blur of motion behind the other door across the lab. Fisher and Chase must have been in place.
Go time, he said.
Tran moved into position, and with a nod, Beckham gave him the order. He flashed the keycard over the door, and it slid open. Beckham brought up his rifle, aimed, and fired a shot into the scientist's neck and then two to his chest. Fisher and Chase opened fire across the lab. Their shots lanced into the soldier working on the mastermind's locks. Bullets peppered his body as he tried to rise to his feet with his rifle. The beast screeched and stomped the floor, a miniature quake vibrating through the floor. Fisher and Chase turned their rifles on the monster, but a scream rang out behind them.
"Don't shoot it!"
Kate yelled, streaks of blood over her face.
"We haven't finished our work."
"Get that thing secured," Beckham shouted.
Tran, Chase, and Fisher approached the loosened shackles cautiously as the monster swiped at them with a free hand. Fisher fired, painting the clawed hand with bullets. The creature shrieked in pain and lashed out at the final chain holding it in place.
"I said don't shoot," Kate shouted.
Fisher glanced over with a crazed look.
"We have to disable those limbs if you want us to secure the damn thing."
"Okay, but don't kill it," Kate said.
Beckham hurried over to her, looking between her and the two shot scientists. He recognized the first. It was Carr. The woman was still alive. She had one hand pressed down over a red spot on her white bunny suit, and her eyes blinked lethargically, her gaze unfocused.
"We need to get her to the hospital," Kate said. "Ron, Leslie, get over here."
Two technicians bolted over from their hiding position and bent down next to the injured woman, while Beckham embraced Kate.
"Are you okay?" Beckham asked.
"The blood's not mine."
He looked her up and down just to be sure. There was no time for hugs or to talk about what happened.
"We have to get out of here, Kate. The outpost's under attack. Variants are on their way."
"We're almost done with our work."
Kate used the back of her gloved hand to wipe some of the blood from her face.
"We're so close. We really can't leave yet. Too many people have already died for this research. It can't be in vain."
Tran, Chase, and Fisher circled the monster, firing at the limbs with short bursts. Blood wept from the dozens of inflicted wounds, its claws starting to twitch uselessly. The enraged creature screeched with each searing round. Two more shots crippled its knee, and the creature finally collapsed to one leg. That gave the men a chance to yank the chains back in place and secure them to the scaffolds. Beckham waved Fisher over.
"Have your men hold sentry in the halls," Beckham said. "We have to buy Kate and her team time to finish their work."
"How long's this going to take?" Fisher asked. "Not long," Kate said. "But I need Sammy."
The other technicians were patching the injured computer scientist up, but Beckham could tell she was in bad shape. She had taken a bullet to the gut. One of the most painful and potentially deadly places to be shot. If her guts had been pierced, the resulting bleeding and infection would be devastating.
"I can work," Sammy croaked. "Just help me up."
They got her into a chair after finishing the bandages. Her face continued to lose color as she tapped at the computer.
We about had my algorithm tuned.
She looked over at the monster.
"Just give me 5 minutes with this bastard."
"Are you sure you can do this?" Kate asked.
"I have to do this," Sammy grimaced. "The thing is agitated, which means we're going to get better results. There's no better testing ground for my language processing software."
Beckham kept his rifle up while the injured scientist fine-tuned her code with repeated queries and answers from the monster. He looked out at the lab's doors with every passing minute, waiting for the eruption of more gunshots. Fisher joined him there, and they spoke quietly while they waited. Finally, maybe 15 minutes later, Sammy slowly pushed back from her computer. The bandage around her abdomen had already bled through.
"Done," she said. "Great work," Kate said.
She helped Sammy to her feet.
"We have to call in an evac now. Get this data somewhere safe," Beckham said.
She motioned at a phone on the wall.
"Ron, see if you can get command on the line."
Kate bent down next to Carr and put a hand on his back.
"We finished the job," she whispered.
Then she bowed her head.
"I'm sorry you couldn't be here to see it."
"I can't get a signal," Ron said from the phone.
"I've got a better idea,"
Fisher said, called from the door he was guarding.
"I've already got a private plane on the tarmac. We can take it anywhere you want to go."
"Anywhere is better than this place," Beckham said. "Get ready, everyone. We move out in 5 minutes.
He looked at the beast as he waited for the science team to gather up their gear and move Sammy. Countless soldiers and multiple scientists had already sacrificed their lives for the intel they had gotten for this abomination. But something told him this was far from over. Timothy hunched behind a shed outside the border of Outpost Portland, trying to find the courage to fight his handlers. Me or them, he thought. From his vantage, Timothy saw a blockaded road with a machine gun nest and patrolling guards. Snipers had to be on the adjacent rooftop watching the walled campus. A second gate blocked off another road with a few guards just beyond it. The buzz of his collar hit his ears before he felt the pain. The jolt nearly dropped him to his knees. Scorching pain flamed across his neck. When it passed, he took in a deep breath, tears brimming in his eyes.
Time to move.
The collaborators were watching him, and if he didn't get going, they would shock him again. Keeping his hoodie cinched above his neck, he walked out from behind the shed and started off down the road, his hands by his side. He made it three strides before a spotlight hit him.
Contact! Shouted a soldier.
Timothy raised his hands in the air.
Get on the ground! Yelled another guard. And don't fucking move!
He dropped to his knees.
It's me, Timothy Temper. I live here.
Footsteps echoed down the street. He blinked to see through the intense light. Two soldiers made their way toward him.
I live on Peaks Island, Timothy said as calmly as he could. All the way on the ground, shouted one of the soldiers over Timothy's explanation. Hands behind your head.
Timothy slowly put his hands on his head and went down to his belly.
Keep your head,
one of them yelled. Before the soldier could finish, his head flew back from a bullet that blew out the back of his skull. Two rounds hit the other in the chest. He slumped next to Timothy, still alive, gasping for air. Screeching tires tore down the road. The black muscle car turned a corner. A pickup followed, and a rocket streaked from the bed. Timothy rolled off the street and into a ditch as the grenade slammed against a mound of sandbags. Another projectile hit two concrete barriers blocking the gate. The explosions shook the ground, and the gate collapsed, clanging against the pavement. He crawled back up as the muscle car sped toward the flames. It thumped over the fallen gate, and the passenger tossed something out the window. Several soldiers at the secondary checkpoint vanished behind a fiery blast. The car raced around the wreckage, followed by the pickup truck, their tires squealing. Timothy rose to a kneel. The dual cab pickup that Pete drove pulled up. Alfred jumped out and aimed his rifle down the street. Then he grabbed Timothy.
Get in, he said, opening the back door.
The other prisoner was gone. Timothy was afraid to ask what had happened to the man who had told him the location of the collaborator's base. Pete drove toward the sound of gunfire and sparkling muzzle flashes from the rooftops deeper within the outpost. The high-pitched shriek of a variant pierced the chaotic noise. Several of the beasts leapt from the shadows and took to the sides of buildings, scaling them like demonic lizards. Near the monsters, a patch of grass and soil gave way. A hulking monstrosity pushed itself from the crumbling soil, and Timothy nearly gasped at the abomination with wide, bat-like ears and a scrunched face. Fangs hung from its mouth. It raised its muscled arms, and long tendrils along its back stood straight like the spikes on a porcupine. Red vines clung to parts of the creature's body as it hoisted itself from the earth. A high-pitched clicking noise sounded, and the other variants burst from the ground where the monster had tunneled, each squirming past the red vines. Collaborators, alphas, and all their thralls were descending on Portland. Timothy couldn't save the outpost, but he could still get the enemy's location to soldiers here. Nick drove down a side street littered with twisted and torched bodies. The pickup thumped over one with a sickening crunch. As the truck sped closer to the university campus, an army of variants bounded along the roads to either side of them. Another alpha exploded from the ground, rallying the smaller monsters and charging toward the heart of the garrisoned outpost.
"You're gonna let the beasts kill them all?" Timothy asked. "You told me if I got you in, you would spare them."
Nick and Pete exchanged a glance, but didn't reply.
"Those that respect the new gods will be spared," Alfred said quietly. "But first, the blood of the heretics must be spilled."
Explosions boomed ahead. Timothy tried to think of a plan to stop the madness, but the faster they raced into the outpost, the more muddled his mind became. If the attack continued at this rate, Timothy wouldn't have anyone to tell about the base.
It's almost over, Pete said with a crooked grin. Soon we'll own this outpost, and our thralls will feast.
The truck stopped at the next intersection with a destroyed checkpoint. Timothy could see the campus now.
This is the spot, Pete said. The others should be here soon.
Fiery blasts and gunfire cut through the night while they waited. It wasn't long until the trucks with the dogs arrived. The guards let the dogs out of their cages, and the abominations took off down the main road into campus. Alfred opened the truck's door, gesturing for Timothy to get out. Agonized screams wailed between the staccato sound of gunshots and the chorus of mutant hounds. They set off towards the battle with six other armed collaborators. Two pickup trucks followed the group as they made their way toward the dormitories. More shrieks split the air. As they got closer, Timothy wanted to close his eyes when he saw the scattered bodies. The collaborators were proud of the macabre scene. They watched in silence, their features stoic. Timothy held back the bile in his throat. Variants and mutated dogs fed on people who had been caught during their retreat. An alpha tore one of the bodies in half and sucked at the corpse's insides. Nearly a dozen people fled in that direction from a side road, oblivious to threats waiting. He wanted to scream and warn them, but it wouldn't matter. In the distance, Timothy spotted more people climbing out of windows to escape variants that had made it into the shelters. A woman jumped from the second floor, only to be torn apart by a pack of prowling beasts outside the building. A man with a pistol fired at four variants surrounding him and two women in the parking lot. They backed toward a parked car. A monstrous dog leaped around the bumper and tackled the man. Its teeth tore into his neck, pulling out sinew, as the two women screamed in horror. Pete held a walkie-talkie up to his ear. Sniper rifles cracked in the distance. The heads of several variants burst in sprays of bloody mist. One of the alphas turned in the direction of the gunfire. Bullets plunged through its body, but still, it advanced, roaring and gathering a cadre of smaller monsters. The Rangers were still in this fight. There might yet be hope to turn the slaughter around.
They're retreating to the command post. Pete pointed the remote at Timothy. You're up. The faster you do this, the faster we call off the beasts.
Timothy nodded and set off down the road, doing his best to ignore the mangled and shredded bodies littering his path. He turned into a parking lot. If he remembered correctly, this one led to another, where more dormitories were. Command was located between those buildings. Several variants and hounds sprinted toward the increasingly sporadic sounds of gunfire. Two diseased dogs ripped apart dead bodies, spilling the organs of carcasses across the asphalt. A few gaunt variants fought for scraps nearby, shoveling mangled flesh into their mouths. Why weren't they attacking him? A bony beast straddling a dead man glanced up at Timothy as he neared the tree line separating the parking lots. Intestines hung from its maw like noodles. But it didn't seem interested in him, nor did the other creatures. They simply looked at him, and then looked away. He didn't hear the pop of the creature's collar zapping him. No way the beast knew that he was one of their allies yet, right? It struck him then. The chip that Nick had implanted in his neck. That had to be it. These beasts probably had them too, and they were all connected somehow. Timothy started searching for a weapon as he walked. Several soldiers had fallen in the trees. He spotted a rifle and ran over, fully expecting a zap from his collar. But none came. He was out of sight from the collaborators now. They would catch up to him again soon, but for now, he was free. He picked up the rifle and grabbed another magazine off the chest of a dead soldier. Then he took a knife and slipped it in his waistband. With the blade, he could excise the chip. That also probably meant the creatures would turn on him if he no longer had it implanted in himself. He stood, armed for the first time since his captivity, conflicted. Part of him wanted to go back and mow down Nick, Pete, and Alfred. But he also knew there was something more important at stake than revenge. The intel he had about Mount Katahdin, if true, could save other outposts from Portland's fate. That was his mission now. He took off for the command post, keeping low until he spotted the building. Several Army Rangers fired rifles from the rooftop at the monster surrounding it. He spotted more guns in the windows. He slunk past the variants closing in on the building, coming so close to the monsters he could smell their sour flesh and sweat. They continued to ignore him, and Timothy made his way to a clearing. He thought about calling up to the Rangers, telling them who he was. They probably wouldn't be able to hear him, and that might only get him shot in all the chaos. Two variants threw themselves at the reinforced door ahead. Another began scaling the wall toward the roof. Grinding his teeth, Timothy took aim and fired. Bullets stitched up the side of the climbing beast. The other two at the door turned toward Timothy. They too jerked and collapsed as he unloaded the rest of his first magazine into their bony bodies. Then he rushed between their corpses and started pounding on the door.
"Please, let me in!" he yelled.
He looked over his shoulder for the collaborators. If they were watching now, maybe they would think this was all part of his ploy to get them into the command post. But even if the collaborators were convinced, six variants prowling along the edges of the clearing didn't seem to be. One took a step forward, dropping to all fours.
"Please help! I'm Timothy Temper, Jake Temper's son!"
He slammed his fist against the door. The pack of variants moved in closer. More gunfire rang out from the rooftops. Screams erupted from the parking lot where the monsters feasted. Timothy levered his hand back, ready to pound again. One of the variants twitched its head as it looked between him and the dead monsters at his feet. It looked as if it was figuring out whether he was an ally or traitor. Then the door flung open.
"Get in, kid,"
someone said, grabbing his shoulder. The door slammed shut behind him, and he was suddenly assaulted with a chaotic din. Down the halls, people ran shouting orders. He saw one soldier covered in blood, gashes along both of his cheeks. Somehow the man was standing, but there were many others slumped against the walls. Several looked dead, with bullet wounds or terrible lacerations from variants covering their bodies. People in civilian clothes were among the dead and dying. Their wails and pleas for help echoed in the hall. Timothy staggered forward, trying to look for someone in charge. Lieutenant Niven or Sergeant Ruckley, someone who he could tell about Mount Katahdin. He rounded a corner, the tile slick with blood. The trail led up a stairwell to the higher levels where the boom of gunfire echoed against the walls. A door suddenly opened behind him and screaming echoed deeper in the building. Turning, he saw two soldiers carrying wounded inside. People pushed and shoved their way into the passage. A female and male soldier came inside last, both carrying children. He recognized the woman.
"Sergeant Ruck!"
A zap from his collar made him drop his rifle. Another shock burned into his neck. He gritted his teeth, gripping the collar. The new group of Rangers and civilians made their way toward him. He reached up toward them, but they all passed him by.
"Ruckley!"
Timothy wailed. She suddenly stopped, handing the child off to another soldier. Then she made her way over to him. A soiled bandage was wrapped around her right arm, and blood streaked down her chest.
"Sergeant," he said, "I have information that..."
A third shock dropped him to the ground. Timothy's eyes teared up as he battled the pain. The collaborators wanted him to open the door, let them in. This was their reminder.
Mount Katahdin," he managed.
"Slow down, kid. Where are you hurt?" She reached down and saw his collar, rearing back at the sight. She screamed for backup while pulling out her pistol and aiming it at his head. Several soldiers ran over, rifles pointed down at him. Outside, the creature's howls came in during the respite of gunfire. Another electronic shock coursed through Timothy's body. Ruckley bent over him with her pistol.
"Mount Katahdin,"
Timothy mumbled.
"That's where the collaborators are. That's where their base is."
"Hey, isn't that Jake Temper's son?"
someone said. Ruckley looked over her shoulder, then back to Timothy. She moved her gun away from his head.
"Jets are inbound, Sergeant,"
shouted a deep voice.
"Everyone find cover."
"Get him in the shelter," Ruckley said. Timothy felt people lifting him up. They carried him down the hall, and then down into a basement filled with frightened civilians. He was put up against a wall as another shock coursed through his body. His vision blurred.
"Timothy, you still with me?" Ruckley asked.
He tried to nod, but his muscles were locked rigid, and the pain was too much. Tears streamed over his eyes.
"Incoming!"
shouted a voice. Timothy thought he heard jet engines. He definitely heard the explosions, and then felt the floor rumbling from impacts. Cries. Maybe triumphant. Maybe out of pain. The electric shocks came again. Over his own agony, he suddenly focused on one thing. The image of Pete, Nick, Alfred, and the other collaborators burning on the ground with their thralls. Dust rained from the ceiling, and the lights winked off, casting darkness over the shelter. The screams that followed were far from triumphant. These were pained wails of agony. They faded away, but he heard one last thing before he passed out. The shriek of a monster. Chapter 26 Fitz crouched inside the shipping container with Team Ghost and the injured wolfhounds that had nearly been butchered alive. The gunfire around the National Accelerator Laboratory had grown more sporadic. But like vultures hovering over carrion, Blackhawks circled the base, their rotors beating the air with a vicious growl. From Fitz's observations, he noticed the birds rotate out, presumably to stay fueled while maintaining eyes in the sky over the base. It made no sense to Fitz. Blackhawks were rare for the military, and how the hell did they have fuel? The collaborators and variants must have been more organized than Command had realized out here. He shook those concerns aside to focus. Those questions would have to be answered later. For now, he had to keep his team alive. If he had kept track of the choppers accurately, there were only two now. The third had departed a few minutes earlier. That meant whoever these people were, they had a place to refuel in range. Fitz risked peering out the cracked open door. Using his night vision goggles, he spotted a chopper circling nearby, machine guns trained on the ground. He turned back to Rico and Ace, who were crouched next to Martin. The wolfhound still seethed in anger from the massacre he'd witnessed, his jaw clenched. Mendez and Dohai were in the back of the container taking care of Hopkins and the other two injured wolfhounds. The man with the missing legs had woken and groaned in pain. Dohai bent down to keep him quiet.
"We can't stay here forever," Rico said. "What's the plan, Fitz?"
Fitz knew when she used his real name, she was worried. He was too. The radios were jammed, they didn't have the Rolling Stone tech, and with the wolfhounds mostly dead and a new enemy out there, he wasn't sure what the right move was.
"Your last plan got all my brothers killed," Martin muttered. "This isn't our fault, amigo, and you're starting to really piss me off," Mendez said.
"Cool it," Fitz said to Mendez. Then he looked at Martin. "You want to blame us? Fine. But if you want to survive, you got to work with us."
"So what's your brilliant plan, then?" Martin asked.
"Shoot those choppers down," Mendez said. "I could plug them with a couple good shots."
"Don't think so," Ace said. "Unless you got something more than that M4.
"Look, we still don't even know who they are," Rico said. "We don't know what they've got in store for us."
A chopper boomed overhead, flying in low as its spotlights traced over the ground. The light flashed inside the shipping container door.
"My guess is collaborators," Dohai said. "Someone compromised our mission."
"I have a bad feeling you're right," Fitz said.
Rico shook her head like she didn't believe it.
"You ever seen collaborators with Blackhawks? Not me. Hell, the Allied States is low on those birds."
Fitz started to reply, but then he heard the crash of metal. The cannibals they had imprisoned in another shipping container had escaped. He pushed open the door a little wider and saw the cannibals streaming toward a thicket of trees to the southeast. The two Blackhawks trained their spotlights on the people and flew over to intercept them.
"We might not get a better chance," Fitz thought.
He rose on his blades and looked at Hopkins. The man's eyes were barely staying open.
"Martin, grab Hopkins," Fitz said.
Martin looked ready to protest, but then grabbed his comrade under an arm.
"Mendez and Dohai, you carry those two," Fitz said. "Rico, rear guard, Ace on me. We're moving. Now."
Mendez hoisted the wolfhound missing his legs into a fireman's carry, and Dohai gave the other soldier his shoulder, helping the man stand. Fitz slipped out of the container, hesitating outside. The two Blackhawks soared above the trees where the cannibals had run. Using the distraction, Fitz led the team away from the containers. Dohai and Mendez managed to keep up, but Martin lagged slightly behind as he helped Hopkins. Rico reached out to assist. All around the campus, fires raged through the buildings from the attack. Oily smoke covered the stars and moon. Fitz signaled to an office building blazing with flames. If his memory served him correctly, going inside and out the back would take them to the warehouses with the Project Rolling Stone tech. With every other route vulnerable to an attack from the choppers, he hoped the structure and the smoke would provide some cover. They would have to cross a wide open space to get there first. Doha jogged next to him, practically carrying the injured wolfhound.
I saw some Humvees earlier that had M240s behind those warehouses. If I can get to them, I might be able to take out those choppers.
Do it, Fitz said. You too, Mendez. Take those two wolfhounds with you and get them secured.
Dohai and Mendez took off. A sudden blast of gunfire made Fitz twist. One of the choppers unleashed a storm of rounds into the trees. Screams sounded, but were quickly silenced. The other Blackhawk peeled off from the woods and started toward Team Ghost and their injured comrades. Its spotlight raked over the ground, just a few dozen yards from lighting up Martin, Rico, and Hopkins. Those three would be the first to be smeared across the pavement. The last sputters of the second chopper's machine guns dissipated. Fire churned through the top of the building ahead. Bricks and chunks of the walls from the crumbling upper floors littered the ground outside the office. Ace was the first there, and crouched with his rifle up. Fitz arrived a moment later and knelt behind a pile of bricks adjacent to Ace. Dohai and Mendez had already disappeared through the blazing building with the other two wolfhounds, but Rico, Martin, and Hopkins were still running to catch up. They weren't going to make it. Rotor wash blew dust and cinder around the hapless trio. In mere seconds, they would be dead. Fitz brought his rifle to his shoulder and fired a burst at the cockpit of the Blackhawk. The bullets sparked off the metal and glass. The 5.56mm M4 rounds couldn't bring down a chopper. If he was lucky, the best he could do was score a shot that brought down a door gunner. None of that was the goal, though. The chopper swerved hard to its right, spotlight sweeping away from Rico and the others. Fitz ran before the light could hit him, using the smoke and scree for cover. Sweat poured down his face as he unleashed another salvo of frantic fire. Bullets painted the office building in response, trailing after him. He rolled away from the spray, got up, and kept running. Ash and embers lifted into the air above when gunfire raked into the building again. The second chopper soared far ahead, looking to cut him off. Caught in a pincer movement, he had nowhere else to go but into the building. He lunged sideways, throwing himself through one of the busted windows on the ground floor. Jagged fragments of glass tore into his flesh like the teeth of hungry variants. He slammed against a desk, then scrambled over broken glass with his gloved hands and knee pads. Bullets punched holes into the floor and drywall. Some lanced dangerously past him, close enough he could hear them whooshing past. Dust sprayed from their impact, kicking up a foggy screen. Fitz scrambled to stand on his blades. Smoke drifted along the ceiling, and he heard the sizzle of burning fire chewing through the building. Coughing, he stumbled into a hall, ducking under a fallen ceiling beam still smoldering. The choppers were strafing the building, sending in gouts of random gunfire. He might have escaped their sight, but he wasn't safe yet. Fitz finally made it to the main hallway.
"Fitz," Rico said.
To his surprise, she now had Hopkins on her back in a fireman's carry. Martin was beside her, chest heaving. Ace had his hands on his knees, trying to catch his breath. Soot covered their fatigues and flesh. Fitz joined them and took point. They jogged down the hall, all coughing through the smoke. Behind them, something crashed through the ceiling. Blackened ceiling beams and ash poured through a hole, along with furniture and drywall still aflame.
"Go, go, go!"
Fitz yelled to be heard over the inferno. They made it to an exit that butted up against a street. Charred cars lined the road. Papers, still burning, fluttered over the asphalt. Fitz cautiously stepped outside. He spied one Blackhawk patrolling on the southern edge of the building. The other bird sounded like it was on the opposite side of the office building.
but he couldn't see with the smoke blocking his view. The third chopper hadn't yet returned. He signaled for the others to follow. With Rico now lugging Hopkins on her back, they moved faster, straight toward the building across the street. The growl of helicopter engines suddenly grew louder. Dark smoke parted with a wave of rotor wash. The first Black Hawk appeared above, spotlights probing the ground.
"Move!" Fitz yelled.
They made it across and into the other building before the helicopter opened fire. Rounds pounded into the doorway, kicking up bits of floor tiles and breaking windows. Fitz didn't stop until they got to the opposite side. Through the windows, he saw cars parked in front of the warehouses where the SDS equipment should be. The Humvees Dohai had mentioned were farther down the road, but he didn't see Dohai or Mendez.
"Master Sergeant!"
a voice shouted. Fitz turned to his right. Through a doorway leading off the hallway, he saw one of the wolfhounds.
"In here,"
Fitz called to the others as he jogged toward the injured man. The wolfhound was propped up behind a desk, his eyes glazed over. Next to him was his comrade, passed out from the agony of his severed legs. The rest of the room was covered in heavy desks and tipped over chairs.
"Dohai and Mendez ran to get the Humvees," the conscious wolfhound said. They told me to tell you they'd be ready when you got here."
Fitz squeezed the wolfhound's shoulder, kneeling in front of him.
"Thanks. You hold tight, and we'll get you guys out of here soon."
Rico lugged Hopkins into the office. She was breathing heavily when she laid him down behind another desk. Martin settled in beside his brothers, and Fitz crouched next to a fallen cabinet. Ace aimed his rifle out a window. The helicopters lowered toward the street, spotlights searching the office windows, lighting up the hallways. They were low enough now Fitz could clearly see the forms of the door gunners and the soldiers working the spotlights. The choppers hovered down the road, passing in front of the warehouses and vehicles, hunting like beasts. But they were hunting in the wrong place. Down the road, Fitz saw Dohai and Mendez emerge in the turrets of the Humvees. They grabbed the mounted machine guns and fired on the choppers. Bullets sprayed through the open side doors and into the door gunners. One tumbled out, falling to the street. The spotlights sparked and burst with incoming gunfire, going dark. Chunks of the glass in the cockpit gave way, fracturing and exploding. The Black Hawk tilted sideways, the pilot dead. The rotor blades broke against the ground, kicking up a wave of sparks as they fractured. The bird erupted into flames, grinding across asphalt until it slammed against the side of the building. Smoke wafted from inside the other helicopter as it lifted away. Dohai and Mendez swiveled their M240s and caught it in their stream of tracer rounds. The bird made it out over the trees past the warehouses before it suddenly dropped, disappearing beneath the canopy. An explosion burst from the woods. Fitz motioned for the team to move out. Rico, Martin, and Ace helped pick up the wolfhounds. They hurried past the wreckage of the first chopper. Judging by the mangled debris, Fitz doubted anyone had survived, but he kept his rifle up anyway. Dohai waved from atop his Humvee. Mendez was propped up at the gun of the other. They were about 20 yards from the entrance to the office. Past where those Humvees were parked were the warehouses where Team Ghost would find the SDS equipment. Finally, they could finish their mission and go home. Then a familiar sound boomed over the horizon. The sound of another helicopter.
"Ah, shit," Martin said, halting.
Fitz tugged Rico down against the ground. The rest of the team took cover next to them.
"Dohai, Mendez, get the hell out of there," Fitz yelled.
The third Black Hawk raced over the burning woods, launching a volley of Hydra rockets that streaked through the smoke and slammed into the warehouses. Heat crashed into Fitz, and the concussive force from the exploding rockets swept over the group in a scorching wave. Moments filled with thuds and explosions passed by in what felt like slow motion. Fitz couldn't do anything but crouch down and pray. Once the bird had expended everything it had, it tore away again. As the smoke cleared, Fitz got up. It wasn't just the warehouses destroyed. Both the Humvees were nothing but scrap metal. Fitz's ears rang as he tried to call out to the others, but he saw nothing except rolling smoke. Their mission had ended, swept away by a deadly inferno. And now, Dohai and Mendez had vanished in the flames.
There was nothing left but the smoldering remains of failure. Beckham hated sitting in the comfy leather seat in the private jet while others were dying on the ground. Fisher had the same guilty look in his eye, and so did Horn. They watched as Kate and a medic tended to Sammy, who had passed out from the pain. In a separate closed-off section of the plane, Javier, Tasha, Jenny, and the dogs were resting, or were supposed to be. Beckham heard nervous chatter coming from the area. He peered out of the window as they flew away from Outpost Manchester. The landscape was consumed in darkness, except for the orange flashes of gunfire and flames now far in the distance. After getting the rest of the technicians into another aircraft, Beckham had gladly taken Fisher's offer to take the private plane. But he couldn't help feeling like he was abandoning the people still down there, just like when he'd been forced to leave Portland. On another day, he would have considered staying, but Presley didn't want to listen to reason or advice. The colonel wanted to do things his own way, and Beckham could see where that was leading now. He would be surprised if there was anything left of Outpost Manchester by the time the sun rose again. Tasha peeked out of the doorway in the back half of the plane.
Are we headed home?
Not right now, Horn said. Can you please go watch Jenny, Javier, and the dogs?
Tasha looked like she was about to refuse.
Please, Tasha, Horn said softly. I need your help.
Okay.
Tasha disappeared into the back of the plane again. Horn looked at Fisher expectantly.
So, do you know where we're going?
The grizzled older man merely shrugged.
We still haven't received the exact coordinates. Ringgold security forces won't give them to us until the last minute to be sure no collaborators intercept our comms.
We have absolutely no idea, Beckham asked.
I've got a trajectory, Fisher said. Headed south toward Long Island until we're told otherwise.
Horn folded his muscular arms over his chest.
Ringgold's right to be cautious, Beckham said. We just saw what happens when we underestimate the traitors in our midst.
The pilot's voice broke over the intercom.
Mr. Fisher, we've got an incoming satellite video call.
Patch it through,
Fisher replied. A screen on the front bulkhead of the passenger cabin sizzled to life. The picture was grainy, and the sound filled with a bite of static. To Beckham, that meant the incoming call was being heavily encrypted to prevent prying ears and eyes. When the image settled, President Ringgold appeared. The wrinkles around her eyes looked especially pronounced, shadowed by dark half-circles. Beckham had never seen her more exhausted.
I'm glad to see you, she started to say. Where's Dr. Carr and the kids?
Kate bowed her head.
Carr didn't make it, but the kids are safe.
Ringgold lowered her eyes a moment.
We completed our work, Kate said. We now have everything we need to tap into the collaborator and variant network.
I'm happy to hear some good news, Ringgold replied.
I just hope that after the night is over, things aren't worse than we predicted.
Beckham felt dread pooling in his stomach. Ringgold's voice sounded shaky when she spoke again.
I'm afraid Outpost Manchester wasn't the only place that has been hit hard. Just as we've suspected, our enemy's initial attacks were only testing our defenses. Combined with the collaborator attacks from the inside, we're losing everything.
She used the back of her hand to wipe her eyes. Beckham could see a layer of tears forming.
I'm so sorry to tell you this, but Outpost Portland is gone. Lieutenant Niven called in an airstrike to take out the collaborators and a small army of variants that surrounded the outpost earlier tonight. That was pretty much the end of it, but they had no choice.
God, no,
Horn said, bowing his head.
Timothy,
came a voice. Horn looked over his shoulder at Tasha, who stood cupping her mouth. He got up and hurried over to her. Beckham felt a tear of his own forming.
How many outposts are left? Kate asked.
General Souza believes we will lose half by morning, Ringgold said. Beckham wiped at his eye and kept it together, knowing despair would get him nowhere.
What about Team Ghost? He asked. If they got the SDS technology from Project Rolling Stone, we could hold out, right?
Ringgold's pause told him all he needed to know.
What? He asked. Did something?
We lost all radio communications with Team Ghost and the Wolfhounds, Ringgold said.
How the hell did we lose contact?
There seems to be something interfering with radio signals around the lab campus, and we lost contact with the C-130 and the remaining group of the Wolfhounds guarding it about an hour ago.
They're all dead?
Beckham's insides twisted. We're not sure, Ringgold replied. Beckham slammed his fist against one of the armrests. Raised voices came from the back of the plane where the kids were with Horn. Beckham should have been back there to console them, but he remained seated to finish the call with Ringgold.
Without the Rolling Stone technology, the variants will destroy what's left of civilization wherever they can tunnel, Fisher said.
There are other threats than tunneling variants now, she replied. We're getting reports of animals the collaborators have infected with VX-99. Dogs, the bats. It's a horror show. My advisors are telling me they must have been working on this for years.
How? Kate whispered incredulously. No one had an answer for Kate. It was something Beckham desperately wished he could answer. Trying to figure out how they had missed all this would not help them bring back the outposts or all the thousands that had died. For now, all they could do was focus on moving forward.
From what we saw, from everything you're telling us, we need to do something quick. But I'm not sure that tapping into the variant network will give us the upper hand, Beckham said. We need something bigger.
I agree. Even if we somehow deployed the SDS equipment soon, there won't be much left for us to defend, Fisher said.
You're both right, Ringgold said. That's why we're ordering a mass retreat to concentrate our remaining assets. Airstrikes around the country haven't stopped them. Recent intel suggests we may have a better ID on some of their bases, but ultimately, according to our estimates, it won't be enough.
Won't be enough? Fisher asked. Then what in Sam Hill are we going to do?
General Souza and I have been in close contact with Cornelius. We've also tried to recruit more foreign aid, but we're not getting much. Even France is calling back the consultants they offered.
So we're alone, Fisher said.
It seems that way, Ringgold said. We've evaluated options, and there is only one that we keep coming back to. One that may be our Hail Mary, and up until now, one that I disagreed with.
Beckham was afraid to ask what the president had in mind, although he sensed where this was going, especially if Cornelius was involved. His gut was right.
I agree with Cornelius now, Ringgold said, lacing her fingers together. As hard as this is for me to say, we need to deploy what's left of our active nuclear arsenal to hammer the variants where they are the strongest. Targets will include all major cities where hives are suspected and collaborator locations have been identified.
Fisher tugged on his mustache but didn't say a word.
I don't harbor any illusions about what this great country of ours will look like if we survive, Ringgold said. We'll be turning our cities into radioactive, festering ruins. But there's no taking them back from what's there now.
All due respect, but we're not just talking about radioactive craters, Beckham said. Don't forget what happened in Europe when the variants were exposed to radiation.
That was mostly due to fallout from nuclear power plants, Kate said. Nuking the bastards will kill them before they can mutate further.
Initially, Beckham was surprised at his wife's tone. But after all they'd been through, he realized he shouldn't have been.
There are communities of people out there living on their own, Beckham said, not to mention refugees. The collaborators have taken our people captive, too. All of them will be condemned to die.
Ringgold's face fizzled in and out of existence.
Yes, I am all too aware of the sacrifices that will be made if we choose this course of action. But we have given the stranded outside of our outposts every opportunity to join us in this fight.
You said this is the best option. But what are the others? Beckham asked.
One is to stay the course.
We already know where that one leads, Beckham said, picturing the beasts swarming outpost Portland and Manchester.
What else?
We try to evacuate whoever we can. Escape across the ocean.
Maybe, Kate said.
But then we're giving North America to these monsters. They'll continue to propagate and grow in strength. Eventually they'll make the journey too.
It doesn't sound like our so-called allies are willing to help us now either,
Fisher said. So why would they take us in, especially if there's a risk we're bringing along collaborators?
There is no guarantee, Ringgold said. That's why I'm leaning toward the nuclear option.
Beckham hated the idea of launching nukes on their soil and cities, the home he had fought for, that he had sacrificed so much for, the place where he had raised a family, where he had done everything in his power to protect his friends and rebuild a better and free civilization. For 8 years they had accomplished that, creating outposts where citizens could live in peace after a lifetime of violence. But as soon as they launched those nukes, the country as he knew it would permanently be gone. The United States, and now the Allied States, would be just a memory.
If we do this, Beckham said finally, everything we know will be left in ashes.
There had to be a better way. He took a moment to think.
What if we attack the major hubs, but hold back most of our nukes? Beckham asked. Maybe we give Team Ghost a chance to complete the mission, pull everyone back to the safest and most defendable outposts. Then, if Ghost fails, we launch everything we've got at those animals.
What do you think, Kate? Ringgold asked. She managed a nod and then reached out for Beckham's hand.
Okay, Ringgold said.
By the time you reach our secured location, the nuclear weapons will be deployed on select targets.
And then we're back to where we started nearly a decade ago, Fisher said. Back underground, hiding from the monsters.
Ringgold grimaced as she turned her eyes downward. When she raised them, Beckham saw a new wave of confidence.
No, Ringgold said. We're not launching these weapons just to hide. She unfolded her fingers and sat up straighter, staring at the camera with raw determination. We're launching them to fight back. Once the smoke clears and the ashes settle, we return to the battlefield and throw every last man, woman, and bullet at the beasts to save what's left of our country.
Blue Heron Audio hopes you have enjoyed our presentation of Inferno, Extinction Cycle Dark Age, Book 2, by Nicholas Sansbury Smith and Anthony J. Melchiori, read by R.C. Bray. Text and audio production copyright 2019, Nicholas Sansbury Smith. Published in arrangement with Blue Heron Audio. All rights reserved. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, copied, or broadcast without written permission from the authors. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.